What was the beverage? I can't believe I'm...
Fresca or no?
It Boku.
Was Boku.
So yeah. Boku, the only reason this is funny is because it's Richard so Lewis was the short-lived spokesperson for this short-lived cola alternative or whatever it was. It
An
was
like adult,
It was like a fancy juice box, basically. And
adult branded juice box.
Yeah. Incredible.
Kind of like how now there's Liquid Death, which is literally still water in a can with like some Ed Hardy bullshit on it.
Mm-hmm. It's exactly like that. But it was pitched for the modern 90s man. Right?
It's like early 90s, right?
Yeah, somewhere in the
early
90
to
95 pocket.
Okay.
And he was very, uptight, but he's a yuppie and it's a juice box for uptight 90s LA yuppies.
But he's like cosmopolitan too.
He knows what you want.
It's like Ecto cooler for people who smoke cigarettes and it's like trying to capture the Zima market.
For sober people.
And they're like, I know who we can get, Richard Lewis.
Yeah.
So it was this whole campaign where there were at least seven different commercials. And he is thoroughly engaged in selling you this drink, but at the same time, the copy he's reading is just so inane that it just sounds strange to hear, like,
and also the name of the drink, Boku, and I believe it had some kind of diacritics on it, or like, it's not just B-O-K-U, it's like B-O with the...
Like tar.
Yeah, like tar. It was sort of like the tar of juice boxes.
She didn't understand me. I'd say, let's have a nice white grape raspberry Boku. We're adults, we can choose. Boku is adult, adult flavors. There's no straw involved. We're talking pull tab here. And can you believe she wouldn't even let me go to the juice box aisle? And she'd drive by the supermarket to see if my car was parked outside. I hear now she's seeing a juice box counselor. All I wanted was a Boku. Boku fruit juice cooler from McCain. Is that too much to ask?
You are listening to the Screen Slate podcast. I'm your host, John Derringer. And on this episode, I am thrilled to welcome, all the way from Los Angeles, California, Brett Berg, head of distribution at the American Genre Film Archive, the mastermind behind the cult favorite streaming show Museum of Home Video, and a genius film programmer. On this episode, I am back on the couch with my co-host, filmmaker and Screen Slate contributor Caroline Gollum, and Anthology's film archivist, John Claxman. We talk about AGFA's restoration work, including Gremlins director Joe Dante's Little Scene found footage masterwork, The Movie Orgy. We talk to Brett about starting Museum of Home Video, and we get an update on LA's exploding film culture, including all the new repertory, micro cinema, and arts venues opening there. You know what LA doesn't have, though, is Screen Slate. And the only reason New York City does is because of our Patreon subscribers. So if you enjoy the pod, check out our repertory film listings, or read the original film writing that we publish daily, visit patreon.com/screenslate and support us. This is the only source of funding we have aside from occasional sponsored emails. Screen Slate's not anyone's full-time job, but the Patreon enables us to pay writers and editors, keep the site up and running, and continue to do what we do. And a huge thank you to everyone who has already signed up. You're helping support everyone who contributes to Screen Slate, and on behalf of all of us, my sincerest thank you. Final thing I'll mention before we begin is that this episode is going live with an extremely juicy full-length bonus episode just for our Patreon members, where we get deeper into LA film culture, the cursed history of the silent movie theater where both Caroline and Brett worked in different iterations, the ignominious end of CineFamily, Kenneth Anger sending cryptic letters to John Claxman, we get a scene report from a weird, exclusive Martin Scorsese Dime Square film screening, and we talk about new movies like Beau's Afraid, Air, and Showing Up. It's a really rich, very salacious, and extremely fun episode. So head over to patreon.com/screenslate. If you're already a member, you can give it a listen right away or sign up to become one. All right, without further introduction, here is Brett Berg.
We're back.
And this popcorn was the most chaotic pre-recording chat. Welcome to the fucking Screen Slate podcast, Brett.
Oh, thank you.
How are you doing, Caroline Gollum?
Oh, I'm all right. Great to be back after my hiatus.
Yeah. It's been a minute since we've had episodes with A on the couch and B with kind of the whole crew. Mm-hmm. We did a few, or I should say I did a few that were over Zoom with filmmakers, relatively short, civil, PR supervised chats. And now we're back, and we were just talking in the few seconds that we chatted before the mics went on about whether to include hot gossip in this episode.
Paywall.
All right, yeah.
That's the new thing. I'm going to announce it now up top. We're going to put hot gossip in this episode, and if you're not a Patreon member, you're not going to hear all the hot goss. So welcome to the podcast, Brett Berg. Brett, is your title like head of distribution at AGFA, the American Genre Film Archive? Do you have a title?
Head of theatrical or head of theatrical sales. It's really one or the other.
Cool. So head of theatrical sales at AGFA, the American Genre Film Archive. And also, I would say, is it one half of the Brain Trust, or are there more of you now at Museum of Home Video, the incredible renegade Twitch stream?
I would say that there's three of us. So myself. So I guess we should describe what these things are.
Yeah. Let's get it. Let's describe what they are. Well, let's start with Museum of Home Video, which may be familiar to some Screen Slate listeners and longtime whatever
fans, because
longtime fans,
Twitch
of the
followers,
show, because we did that Twitch stream together during the pandemic. But yeah, why don't you tell us about Museum of Home Video, what it is, and how you started it?
Okay. Museum of Home Video started on Twitch, and now, as of now, since we've been booted, we are at our own URL, museumofhomevideo.com. And it is my show on Tuesdays is a weekly found footage variety show for stoners, seekers, archivists, and drinkers. Chances are, if you watch it, you're at least one of those four.
I identify with many of those.
I would say pretty much all of them.
Same.
Yeah.
So, it's no surprise that in the early days of the pandemic, when Screen Slate was streaming on Twitch, when Spectacle was streaming on Twitch, and when Museum of Home Video started, it was a necessary thing at the time, but I have continued every Tuesday doing a silly found footage show for people who like appointment viewing, because we've sort of brought that back.
Yeah, and that was really incredible during the pandemic, just knowing every Tuesday night, it was like, okay, I'm not going to be drinking alone. I'm going to be drinking with other people who are watching Museum of Home Video on Twitch. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the rare things, I think, that has really continued to thrive since the pandemic. Like, you know, these jokers like Screen Slate, who, you know, just kind of abandoned their Stream Slate program after the
that's true. I was
the
just thinking about that
conclusion of the pandemic that is no longer happening. No, I'm just kidding.
That's true. It really is over. But I want to hear about the
pandemic. Or Stream.
Well, now, yeah, when Screen Slate stopped streaming, it was
that
over.
Was kind of that was when people knew. Yeah. That was when Fauci was like, fuck it.
Well, John is back to normal. John Derringer's back to normal. No, but I want to hear about the corporate overlords. They banned you from Twitch because of your content, copyrighted content.
It's tough to say. I read an article, I can't remember what outlet it was, a few months ago that said Twitch was on the decline overall as a platform. There's fewer creators that are participating in it, and the pay is going down for the people who do participate in it.
No, but wait. So did you get booted off Twitch, or you decided to leave?
We got booted.
Okay.
We spring, summer of last year, there was a wave of Twitch deletions for people who were doing, streaming stuff.
Big Jazz got booted too.
Not video games.
Not video games, yeah. And we got a couple copyright strikes, but we couldn't really tell what they were for because they don't tell you. And then we got, there was a half of a butt crack that I left, because usually I try to edit the show without nudity because Twitch has this thing about nudity. So there was a half of a butt crack, and then 2 minutes later, stream was shut off.
Well, damn. I don't think there's anything more punk than getting booted off Twitch because of a butt crack.
So
you want to be on that platform anyways.
It was like getting a grant from a rich foundation to do streaming, to start streaming stuff. But yeah, ultimately, I don't want to be making money for Bezos, right?
I think it's a very good entry level means of familiarizing yourself with live streaming, though. Which, like, the ease of use is a testament to how many different things kind of proliferated on it during season one of the pandemic.
Totally.
Spectacle got booted for when we did a stream of Themrock.
Oh yeah.
Because that movie's got a lot of nudity in it, but also a very cool thing to get booted for, in my opinion.
Did it get booted within 2 minutes, like the butt crack? Or
it happened pretty quickly. I don't think I was running the stream that night, but whoever was like, oh yeah, we got booted like in the program.
It seems like a bot thing, and it seems like it's becoming increasingly draconian even for gamers and stuff. Like every video game now has what's called like streamer mode, where
it covers up the nudity.
It'll do like whether it's licensed music or logos in game, or if there's like nudity or adult content.
If there's butt crack,
because streamers are getting kicked off Twitch even just for using Twitch for its intended purpose of playing video games and meeting fellow e-boys and e-girls.
So it's like a censorship mode that you turn on?
Dude, they have that. A buddy of mine used to work for B&H.
I don't like this.
The photo video. You'll appreciate this story, Brett.
Yeah.
He was working in the office at B&H, like in their office, like doing stuff. And they have, because it's a religious business, shall we say, like a browser plugin on their work computers that like cover up any kind of like flesh tone, period. Mm. Not just porn, like not even a porn, just like if you were looking at like a Sears catalog and there was a woman's elbow kind of thing there, then it fills it in like the bras drawn onto the TV cut of Showgirls. It like pencils in like an overlay or something. It's pretty wild.
So in reality, I don't really know what we got booted for. And I suspect my conspiratorial thinking leads me to say that we weren't making money for them. We were getting a lot of engagement and we weren't participating in their affiliates or partner programs, which sticks pre-roll ads on your stream. And I think that they were looking at us very closely because of that. And then there happened to be the butt crack and then we just...
Right. Like there's probably built-in forgiveness to the algorithm that's scrubbing for this kind of content if you are a like high audience count streamer or...
Or they found a reason to boot you. They're like, oh, we found it. There was butt crack.
But also, could you elaborate a little bit more about the content of the show? Like, what are these videos you're showing? Where did you find them? How do you structure these shows? Because they all have really wonderful thematic programs and also just a really distinctive voice to, let's say, like the era or the type of thing that you show in terms of whether it's like, you know, lost promotional video cassettes that have been digitized or television commercials, sort of forgotten or disreputable films that have been re-edited and stuff like that.
Yeah. I call it a found footage variety show. And I also call it college radio for the eyes. It's a highfalutin way of talking about taking commercials and a movie that's too long and cutting it down to 15 minutes and then some weird shit from late night TV, talk show appearances, bloopers, strange things from YouTube wormholes, weaving it all together, just kind of like a classic mixtape, giving you highs and lows emotionally, traveling along this 2.5 hour journey kind of like, I don't know, in From Beyond with Jeffrey Combs, when he gets the little like, you know, the little gland.
Yeah, the pineal gland grows out of his head.
Yeah, and it's a drug without drugs.
And so how did you get into programming? Because you have a really particular programming sensibility. You've worked at video stores, you've programmed at cinemas. Do you want to talk about your journey into cinema? Like, what is Brett Berg's origin story?
Well, born and raised in Los Angeles and outside of New York City, the west side of Los Angeles, especially at that time in the 80s and 90s growing up, was the most prolific area for both multiplexes and art houses, single screens, repertory. It was all just at my feet. So I just grew up going to the movies early and started working at video stores right out of college. And then I worked at a place called Cinephile Video for a decade, which is next door to the New Art. This is a iconic single screen art house in West Los Angeles.
Yeah.
At the same time, I was also on KXLU, which is a college radio station in LA. So I was simultaneously, you know, recommending loaning movies to people and was also presenting a show on radio.
But you weren't a college student. You just had a show on the college station, or you were a college student also?
It was at LMU, Loyola Marymount University. And I was a student there for a couple years and then dropped
the fuck
out.
You kept your show.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. It was not worth it attending. Financially, it was not worth it attending this
university.
It's
cool that they let you.
You never completed a college degree?
Correct.
Hell yeah.
Well, it's cool to let you. I like college radio stations that let people who don't go to the college have shows. Because I did college radio and we used to do that also. It's great.
Oh, it's lovely.
That's the way it should be.
It taught me everything I know. I'm so grateful to it. I would have paid tuition to KXLU, but I had to pay it to LMU in order to get onto KXLU. And so after those two things, I was the director of programming at Cinefamily in Los Angeles, RIP. Mm-hmm. And I was there for seven years.
What happened to that? No, sorry.
Oh, boy.
Well, be the Patreon content.
Oh, God. This whole thing could entirely be about that. So we'll talk about the good things instead.
All right.
So...
But Cine Family during that time, I think we could say, had a reputation for having some of, if not the best, repertory in art house film programming in the country.
Thank you. Yeah. I'll take that. And a lot of the times we were inventing our own shows, much like, you know, many venues here do also. We were inventing our shows out of thin air, and that was my found footage training, really. And so Museum of Home Video now is a combination of being a manager at a video store and being a programmer at a cinema and getting up there and talking about the movie beforehand and presenting a show like on college radio. It's all these things in one. And that's why I think it's probably the best thing that I've done to date, is because it takes all these things from my life and puts them together.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And I mean, that's a really fun thing when you're programming at a smaller, more intimate cinema, when you can be like the, there's a showmanship aspect to it, mm-hmm. where it's not just like, oh, what are we going to put on the screen to sell tickets to keep the theater open? It's about how do I want to express myself personally through what I'm showing or curating for this audience? How do I want to set the mood, whether that's through an introduction, even things like the music you might play or the pre-show you might create. And also when you're there in person, you have that really wonderful interaction with people. And so that's an aspect of film programming that's always really applied to me, but I think, or sorry, not applied, appealed to me, but is, you know, oftentimes quite rare. And I think that's something that you did very well. Yeah, I think that also applies to other people on this pod.
Yeah, I remember Cine Family. Cine Family being like good about having these like recurring film series that people who didn't work there or people from the scene like sort of came back on a regular basis to present their film series, which is maybe kind of what you're talking about in a sense.
Mm-hmm. I do want to point out that LA right now, post-lockdown has, and we were talking about this many times.
I mean, I kind of wanted this almost to be like the meat of the show. I think what you're about to talk about.
So there's just so many venues in LA showing movies and showing movies on film, if you care about that. And
we do.
It's like a really pivotal moment in the city's film going scene because there's just so many. And I was trying to rattle them off. Let's see if I can get them all. USC, UCLA at the Hammer, Brain Dead, Academy Museum, New Bev, Alamo, Secret Movie Club has two different locations, but we'll call that and count that as one.
Legion Hall,
the Los Feliz 3, the Arrow, Whammy, which if none of you have been to Whammy yet, if anyone listening is in LA and hasn't been to Whammy, correct that, because I think it's a fantastic new place.
Yeah, I've sent Whammy our publications to sell and stuff. I can't even remember if we did a wholesale thing or I was just like, I'm honored for you just to sell, you know, our Jackass zines.
Yeah. Don't forget the most important of the venues that you've listed. The most eagerly anticipated.
Oh yeah, there's several that haven't opened yet. There's Vidiots. We're going to get there. There's Vidiots is coming very soon. They announced their opening at the beginning of June. And then there's the Lucas Museum, which will have two screens in Exposition Park. And then the Egyptians opening back up. And the Vista's opening back up soon. There's just a ton of places right now.
Damn.
And the vibe is palpable because everyone wants to be there. Everyone is stoked to come back in these places and make them whole again.
Right. And if we've forgotten anything, it's because it's so cool that we want to keep it underground and not.
There's probably like four more venues opening in LA in the time that we've spent. Yeah.
One I already forgot about was 2220 Arts and Archives, which houses more than one roving series, including Mezzanine and Los Angeles Film Forum.
Yeah, yeah. Damn.
They also do screenings at the Gene Autry Museum of the American West.
Yes,
which I would love to go to. I haven't been yet.
What about the Hollywood Forever Cemetery?
Oh,
there's
yeah.
There's the outdoor shows.
That thing happens.
Yeah.
Damn.
There's a lot going on.
Wow.
A lot of new places.
So we need a Screen Slate LA is what I'm hearing.
I wouldn't mind it. There's a couple websites that do that kind of thing, but they don't involve any criticism. Mm-hmm. They don't involve the arts. It's really just film only, whereas mm-hmm. Screen Slate is film and the arts, which I think is equally important.
I mean, that was kind of like part of the foundational thing, is like thinking of cinema sort of holistically and blah 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 and, you know, whatever.
But one question though, LACMA doesn't show movies anymore, right? That's over, right?
The film program at LACMA is over, but the Academy Museum is literally next door.
Yeah, yeah. So they just like stopped. So like, oh, you can just go over there.
Yeah.
Wait, was the LACMA the Hammer Museum or are those two different?
It's different.
Hammer's in Westwood, LACMA's in Mid-City.
God, I don't remember.
But LACMA had this cool like wood paneled.
Yeah, their screening room was super 70s.
Very wide, you know?
Yes.
Oh, no, I remember that.
The Bing Theater at LACMA.
There was like a Oshima retrospective.
I saw Adventures of Robin Hood for the first time ever at that theater. An amazing time.
I think the last thing I ever saw there was Altman's Quintet.
Cool. So how was it?
Is that theater just gone? Is that theater gone?
Totally. They tore down the entirety of LACMA and they're starting over.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it sucks.
God damn, I didn't know that.
But you can still see the Japanese pavilion from the tar pits. I was there the last time I was in LA.
Mm-hmm. It's this overwrought billion-dollar, years-long project, much like the Academy Museum was, because that was supposed to open 4 or 5 years
ago. It was supposed to be in a different location.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Brett, do you have Instagram?
I'm not on Instagram. Oh. I generally don't do social media because between AGFA and Museum of Home Video, I have no time to do it. I don't have time to do anything except those two things.
You mentioned an acronym, AGFA. Do you want to talk about that is?
That's not the film company, right?
Not the film company. That's a European concern. No, we are the American Genre Film Archive. And we are a nonprofit based out of Austin, Texas. And we house several thousand 35 feature prints. We have a Blu-ray label. We restore films and preserve them. And we have a Blu-ray label that we put that stuff out into the world. It's part of the Vinegar Syndrome network of extended labels. And my job is we also do all the theatrical bookings for all the other labels like Arrow and Severin, Vinegar Syndrome, Shout Factory, Cult Epics, and Troma. Mm-hmm. Those are all the big ones.
And AGFA is a nonprofit, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we are a 5-person team.
Wow. Damn.
And so AGFA, is it currently like a freestanding independent nonprofit? Because as I recall, it sort of started out of Drafthouse and supported...
Yeah.
Almost like a nonprofit arm of Drafthouse, but it's been sort of now separated and is its own entity.
Yeah.
What's the history?
Ding, ding, ding. You got it. And it was 15 years ago about where there was a nonprofit started by Tim and Carrie League, who founded Alamo Drafthouse, to save the original location in Austin on Colorado Street. There was going to be a developer that was going to knock like a lot of stuff down on the block, including them, and they tried to save the building, but they were unsuccessful. In the meantime, they spun the nonprofit into dealing with Alamo's growing film print collection, which came out of Tim's screening stuff that he bought off eBay and the gray market or what have you.
Yeah.
And about 10 years ago, we did a Kickstarter to get a film scanner and started doing preservation work back then. And now we're up to about 50 disc releases. We did the Doris Wishman box sets last year, which is a big success for us.
Yeah, excellent.
We do a whole lot of stuff.
So where do the film materials come from now, if not from Tim? Where do you find this stuff?
The film archive itself has slowed down the growth to almost zero only because we just were out of room.
Interesting.
But all the theatrical rights, those are all DCP and Blu-ray screenings that we license like any other distributor. But the film prints still get into circulation. Our print of The Cure in Orange is going to be playing at the Academy Museum in the summer.
The Cure concert.
Mm-hmm.
Damn. Is that like a Swedish sex movie, The Cure in Orange?
No, that's the other 98%.
I would fly out for that.
I Am Curious Orange.
Well, you know, I was like, maybe there's
that's the fall
one.
Record. So you're not collecting as much. The archive is not collecting as much as far as film elements.
Correct. Yeah. Just trying to take care of what we have in the existing collection. And at this point, preserving the most preservation worthy things, because we often have the only print of something, whether it's some obscure 70s drive-in rarity or whether it's a 90s Hong Kong film, which we ended up with the lone extant print of, for example. Mm.
And I also, we programmed recently an anthology, which came from you guys, the Movie Orgy.
Oh, yeah.
And I really appreciated y'all getting that out there in better quality.
Yeah, this was the very first project by Joe Dante and John Davidson. John Davidson is an interesting character. His IMDb page has interesting character. And he's an awesome person, but he's not a character. You know what I mean? And he produced Airplane and Top Secret.
And like RoboCop
and Starship Troopers. Like, he's a real head.
Shout out to RoboCop.
Oh, this guy's got great taste.
Yeah. So the two of them, Joe Dante directed, edited, and John produced this hours-long found footage megamix, one of the first of its kind, feature-length, you know, predating Everything is Terrible, TV Carnage, etc.
Feature length times two.
Yes, it's 4.5 hours. Started at 7 hours, and Joe let me know right before we premiered it at the Academy Museum that the way that it was, every screening was a test screening. They were constantly showing it in front of people, doing the live VJ thing between two projectors. I'm like going, oh, that bit didn't work. Let's take that out. And they would whittle it down to today. It's 4.5.
Wow.
It was the best 4.5.
I really recommend seeing this when you can. And it's...
Is it coming back or is it...
Well, we showed it in Anthology.
No, I know, but you're not bringing it back.
We showed it for 3 screenings. I told everyone on the internet, don't miss this. It's free. Mm-hmm. This is the new AGFA restoration. We're doing it 3 times, so don't miss it.
Hey, I knew it was happening. So I just couldn't go. That's why I'm asking if it's coming back.
Well, it's not coming back to Anthology.
It's interesting because I think on the last episode, I can't remember if this made it into the final cut of the episode or not, but with Genevieve, we were talking about Carolee Schneemann and Fuses and how she and, of course, many other experimental filmmakers will edit their things after the fact, or maybe they'll show it at a different film speed. And so we, as the public or removed in time, tend to think of things as being these fixed projects, when in fact there is a uniqueness to each presentation of it, and like a protean malleable aspect.
Sure. But my understanding is, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, Brett, here, is that Joe Dante kind of locked in a sort of definitive version when he made this like SD standard definition version. And that's how I saw it originally. Right. And you know, when I saw it, I think I saw it in France, actually, at the Cinémathèque Française, quite a place to see the movie Orgy. But I was like, this is made to be a DCP because this SD copy looks bad now. And there was a forced intermission break because they had to change DigiBeta tapes or DVDs or whatever they were showing because they couldn't, you know, it's too long to fit on one. So I was like, this is perfect for a DCP. So when I saw y'all did that and it showed at the Academy Museum, I saw there's this new restoration. I was like, we got to get that in Anthology. I don't want to get scooped by anyone in New York City.
Well, thank you. It was something that was a labor of love from the whole team. We really try to be found footage forward. Obviously the person behind Museum of Home Video, like you, it's good that I work for an organization that's found footage forward, because we're an archive. But we just wanted to do more found footage theatrical releases. So we have all of Everything is Terrible's films in our catalog. We have this great movie called Triple Fisher by Dan Kapelowitz. It's amazing. It takes the 3 different TV movies about the Amy Fisher story, and it cuts them all.
I've heard this is played at Nighthawk not long
ago.
Wait,
when did he make it? Because my former roommate just played John Bobbitt in a made-for-TV, maybe like shortly before the pandemic.
He made this edit about 10 years ago. All 3 TV movies are from when the Amy Fisher scandal was happening.
Yeah, this was a new one.
Yeah, one had Drew Barrymore, one had Alyssa Milano.
Yeah. I'm not trying to like humble brag that I know the guy who played John Bobbitt in the recent Hallmark version.
It'd be in a Hallmark movie about John Bobbitt?
Yeah, no big deal. I know the guy who's in it.
Have you seen the movie?
I have to have him on the pod. No, I haven't seen it.
I guess I appreciate being found footage forward because that's not, you know, as far as rights go, can get a little iffy. So sure. I really respect, you know, putting resources into that kind of work and to get it out there.
Yeah.
How do you deal with that?
Because if you're like a business, it's not necessarily something you would invest in, you know,
well,
a for-profit business.
We wanted to start gathering more of these movies together in our theatrical catalog because I like playing them. I like showing them to people, and I know other venues like showing them. With something like the movie Orgy, which does use footage from recognizable 50s genre movies, at Joe's behest, we made it. Every show has to be free admission, and we don't charge screening terms for it.
Yeah.
I don't know if that actually works when it comes to you know, if we got in trouble from whomever, but I doubt we're getting in trouble.
Yeah.
I'd always should advertise that. Strike that for the record. Like public domain.
Well, I mean, there's lots of arguments you can make for found footage.
I mean,
being fair use, but
I feel like no, you couldn't win that court case, but you probably could be a huge nuisance to someone if you wanted to by threatening to fuck with them.
Well, when it comes down to it, I respect that AGFA is put resources behind making a nice copy of this
thing that was legendary that no one could ever see.
Yeah. It's very hard to see. Yeah. And I think it's kind of a lost classic of avant-garde found footage filmmaking. Even though the screenings have to be free. So like you guys put resources into it when you're not really going to return anything on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I respect that.
You could say that we get branding recognition out of it,
sure.
But at the same time, I was selfish. I wanted to just watch it and I wanted to watch it in an audience and I wanted to make it easier for people to do because you had to contact Joe Dante, which, you know, not everybody knows how to get in touch with.
Owen gave me his email. I'll email Joe Dante right now.
I was talking to Owen at the Martin Scorsese David Johansen doc. He was sitting next to me and he said, how do I see the movie orgy? I also missed it. I said, Owen, we showed it 3 times and it was free. And I said, you don't know Joe Dante? You can't get in touch with him? You have a personal connection. Yeah. He told me he only met him 1 time.
Really?
Yeah, when he was like 14.
Oh, wow.
Or something.
I actually did email him recently and was like, my friend Owen Klein gave me your email, which he got from his mom.
Because Owen Klein's...
star of Gremlins 1 and 2.
Yeah, Owen Klein's mom is the star of Gremlins 1 and 2.
Well, thank you.
Great episode.
We got our name dropping done.
Yeah.
Thank you for being into it because it's one of the, I think, one of the most exciting things that AGFA has done in recent memory.
And I agree, it is really fun to watch with an audience. Like, that's kind of the best part of it, right? Like, this is a 4.5-hour movie. It's very funny, but also I think it's very sort of scathing in a sense. Like, it's a scathing commentary of like post-war America, and it's just to watch it with a bunch of people. It's 4.5 hours. You're really like giving yourself over to it. It's
a
really
durational work.
Definitely.
Well, that's what I was trying to get at too about the sort of the link to the avant-garde, which I wasn't trying to make a comment on like, oh, it's fixed now, but just to say that it's part of this tradition of artists who are kind of tinkering with their work constantly.
Definitely,
that,
definitely.
Even the way a lot of the people I talked to who went to, they sort of came and went, you know, it wasn't like people showed up 10 minutes early. And
part of that is it being free too, which
like, yeah.
I feel like
but
that does
like
encourage it.
Kind of thing, yeah.
But that's cool. Like, I think this is part of the, even though you're not getting the return and it's a maybe selfish, like this kind of program will proliferate because it affords people an opportunity to communally come in and out of a space, watch a movie that like doesn't necessitate the need to follow a plot. If it's a found footage film, it's just sort of, it's like you can kind of dip in and out at any time. Like that's a really tremendous thing to do.
And
make a work that lets people do that freely.
And
you know?
I personally thought it was important to situate this work within the avant-garde by showing it at Anthology. I thought that was important. Although I will say most of the people in the screening I went to stayed the whole time.
Oh, really? Damn.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm not trying to narc on anyone who may or may not.
Well, I mean, I think coming and going was always part of it. Like, especially when it was 8 hours long, right?
Yeah. Well, Joe himself, when he introduced it at the Academy Museum, encouraged people to come and go in a funny way, you know, like, go get some pizza, come back.
But, I saw a new film.
Oh.
Oh, yeah. Let's hear about it.
Evil Dead Rise.
How was it?
I saw the trailer for that movie four times.
There's
at
a bus shelter poster for it near my house.
It's one of those movies that it feels a bit nostalgic where I'm like, this was advertised for so fucking long that I was actually like, well, you know, this actually used to be what it was like, that you would just see a fucking trailer for a movie forever and it wasn't coming out in like 2 weeks. You're like, oh, that's coming out in like 2 months or whatever. So in a way, it's kind of wild that Evil Dead Rise has finally opened and I have seen it for myself.
But, and was it better than the 2013 one?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it was funny because I met up with Brett afterwards at a bar called Mother's.
But you didn't go to the movie, Brett.
No, we connected after.
Okay. Have you seen the movie?
I should have invited you. No. I just figured you didn't want to spend your time in New York seeing Evil Dead Rise.
I would totally have done that.
But, at Regal Union Square.
I think I did text you like, you know, and of course you're welcome to come.
Oh, yeah. Like, I haven't been here in a couple of years, and it's nice to reconnect with a lot of different people kind of all at once.
So, but yeah, they put on the Evil Dead 2013 at the bar after.
Oh, like cool.
They somehow knew. And I was like, man, this movie is really, that's one of those movies that it's like, it obviously fucking sucks. And people are trying to come back around on
the 2013
a little
bit. One.
Well, it's 10 years old now, so it's in repertory, you know?
And I think it's not the worst movie. There are things I like about it. As I remember, because I haven't been able to get to the ending on any subsequent attempt to rewatch, I remember the ending being like much more decent than the rest of the film. But even just watching it on that bar TV, I was like, this movie is fucking bad. But then we came home and watched Demons 2, which Evil Dead Rise is obviously very indebted to, because they're both films about high rises with demons and shit.
What year is Demons 2?
I think 1980. That's a good question.
6 or 7?
I'm just trying to place it in my mind.
I believe it's an AGFA title.
No, is no. I wish.
I think I got a print. Maybe we might have, a print. I think I got a print from your collection. Yeah, there's probably showed them both in a
print, but not the rights.
Correct.
Yeah, I showed them in a series called "The Medium Is the Massacre." Both Demons 1 and 2
at Anthology Film Archives.
At Anthology Film Archives, prints on loan from AGFA. This is how the sausage is
people
made,
coming together. Yeah,
yeah.
I love it whenever you cover the meat and potatoes of. The non-movie picking parts of the film programming
job. Well, I think that's kind of what the Screen Slate audience is interested in, but doesn't hear elsewhere. Things where it's like, oh, you know, you had a print, but not the rights.
Yeah.
You know, and like...
That's the inside baseball stuff, but I think people find that interesting because it's like detective work.
It is like detective work, especially if you want to get into that field, which more people, I think, want to do these days.
Yeah.
Now that they kind of understand that it's a air traffic controller type job a lot of the time and not a creative job.
Well, you're dealing with also shipping, like FedEx. I think we kind of talked about FedEx on the
film inspection.
Man, what an exciting podcast. FedEx tracking, but
the glamorous side.
But if you don't know how to do that, then you are not a programmer.
Exactly.
And
it's not like picking movies, man.
Yeah, you can have your word curator, which means nothing. But
it means you don't know how to print a shipping label.
Yeah, do you do standard overnight or do you do express saver?
If you've ever had a boss complain about the cost of toner, you know, printing shipping labels, forget about it. But and I also think the term programmer has more, I guess, like working class kind of, you know, really,
it implies a hard skill versus a soft skill, perhaps.
Right. Curator is
that's
like,
right. You're right.
I think curator is a soft skill, which is not to denigrate the soft skills at all.
That's a good way of.
But they are both equal. There's room for the hard and soft skills.
I think of the term curator too as having a social component to it. Like obviously, there's an element of taste in what you're curating in terms of choosing. But I also think people in that kind of role who have the title curator are also sort of. It's like that there's that element of social grace that you need to excel in a job that has that title. And it's not just about your taste or the presentation. It's about how you're able to talk to people at like cocktail parties, basically. And whereas programmers, they're probably like the most socially awkward, difficult to communicate.
I think that's a broad generalization.
All right.
I don't know. Brett, would you consider... Well, I was going to ask you about this actually earlier when we were talking about Museum of Home Video and your work as both a public figure and a private person and how you are such a fantastic personality apart from also the work that you do behind the scenes.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that, about being a public face or putting yourself out there as like, shall we say, a tastemaker or arbiter, a personality? It's your showbiz personality.
I was not a theater kid.
No, I know.
But I respect the let's put on a show, but actually making the show happen and then getting people to come back for the next show.
Mm-hmm. And the promotion and the legwork.
Yes. Showmanship.
Flyering, the stickering.
Yeah. Showmanship.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
It is a trade. And an art, but I lean more on the trade side of it. Just like, this is what you got to do. I came from college radio, so I had a decade of talking to an imaginary audience in my head. And there's really, to me, not a lot of difference between doing a radio show and public speaking in front of people. You just have to, I don't know, zone out. You do the thing where you imagine they're all like making silly faces, and then you smile, and you're not so stressed out by being in front of them or something.
Yeah, I think there's a real art and craft to doing a good film intro. You know, be brief, you know, make some jokes.
No spoilers.
No spoilers. Give people some context.
Yeah.
I think you should go up there with a 10-page essay that you read word for word.
People do that, and that's horrible.
No, I'm just kidding. Yeah. I just have to wing them. Like, if I try to even have a note card, I'm like, I can't do it.
Yeah, so. Same.
And I feel like I'm very hit and miss. Sometimes I'm like, man, that was a fire intro. I did a really good job. And then other times I'm like, oh, God.
So I've been doing them now weekly in downtown LA at the Alamo. So I have a series on Wednesdays. And
what's the name of that series? Does it have a name?
It does have a name. It doesn't say the name unless you click on the page. It's complicated. It's called Wild Things.
Okay.
Now, most of the Alamo locations have a Terror Tuesday and a Weird Wednesday, and like at the big city ones, right?
And Wild Things is a reference to the movie Wild Thing?
No, it's actually because I was busy on Tuesdays, so I couldn't do Tuesdays, so... I was like, we can't do the Terror Tuesday, Weird Wednesday. It just like,
yeah,
you know, let's just do one movie twice. So we needed to come up with a new name, and the name had to just communicate like something that was exciting. And also all the movies, I don't like weird. I mean, I like the word weird, but I didn't want it to describe the thing I was doing.
And maybe overused also when it comes to movies.
I like using it when it's very, very appropriate.
Yeah, yeah.
Like going back to the auteurist, you know, disaster thing. We're in an area of reviving Southland tales now.
Perfect film. Perfect politics.
Which I probably had a Beau is Afraid type reaction to at the time. And now I can begrudgingly understand that it's like, you know, it's an interesting thing.
Mm-hmm. Man,
what was I talking about?
I don't know.
Programming.
Oh, you're serious.
20 years
thing.
From now, people are going to be shit talking the Screen Slate pod. Like, they didn't get Bo is Afraid.
No, I stand behind it.
Yeah. So I don't know. I'm using these shows to just get back out there and do public speaking again, because when you're not in public for a year and a half and then suddenly you're like back in public. I just felt like I wanted to get back in the habit of it. And I treat it more like, I don't know, like practice for a sport. Mm-hmm. It is a sport. It's kind of like me being a mad scientist trying to figure out what makes 50 people really get into it and want to trust later picks also.
Yeah.
So wild is the word that came to mind, and Wild Things was just like the first pop sounding idea that I had for it.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think that's a really fun aspect of programming when you have a recurring series. It's like the audience is coming back because they trust the particular voice that you establish through what you show.
And it's also like almost like a scrimmage. Like, they're enjoying going to the basketball practice with you to go on this journey for like an hour.
And you're right. It's also similar to college radio.
Yeah.
My weekly radio show. Like, you listen to the radio show because of the DJ, not, you know.
And
you trust
appointment viewing.
And appointment viewing.
Yeah.
Who knew that we would circle back to this whole appointment viewing phase in our lives? Like, Pluto is interesting because Pluto mimics the linear cable idea.
Yeah.
And it's kind of not appointment viewing because it's like any channel is just going to be one thing for 24 hours a day. That's a new fun development in TV. But
Fail Army.
Yeah, Fail Army, or just the MST3K channel. Or,
what's Fail Army?
That's fine. Well,
Brett, do you have a favorite title in the AGFA database, by the way?
Oh, like on the theatrical side, like that we have the rights to?
Or I would say even, let's remove whether or not you have the rights to it, but just like a print in your collection.
Oh, boy.
Maybe we could even marry it to like there's a specific print and it's not even just the film.
Huh.
That's a big question.
I have
a big question. I'm rolling through a couple thousand titles.
Yeah.
There's like, okay, we have that. Well, I'm going to make it something that's been on the label before. I'm going to say Bat Pussy. And Bat Pussy is this thing.
Whoa, can you say that on the Screen Slate podcast?
Sorry. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I do not know what you're talking about.
Okay.
I want to see it, though.
It was the very third disc release of ours. And it was something from the Something Weird video canon. Because we took over we're the primary driver of putting their Blu-rays of that stuff out these days.
Did you receive their film collection?
We received their SVHS Tape Master collection.
Interesting.
And we have a lot of titles in our print archive that were those releases also. Lisa Petrucci of Something Weird donated/sold a bunch of stuff to us. There's a lot of interchange.
Sold films to you. Film prints.
I think so. It's been like 10 years. Interesting. I can't remember. But what am I saying? Bat Pussy is our third disc release, and it comes from that world. And it is the first porn parody.
Interesting.
From 1969, 1970. But all details about it are unknown, like cast, crew, location, release date, anything. It was a print that was discovered in a booth somewhere.
Wow.
And so it's incredible because it's very Warhol-like.
Is it a 16-millimeter film?
16-millimeter film. It's very like My Hustler or something, but it's these two annoying people that just yell at each other in a room, much like a Warhol film.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And they have an ongoing dialogue about whether or not each other's going to fuck them. And they have non-sex, which is like an attempt at it, but it doesn't really happen.
Wow.
And the director is off-screen yelling direction at them. And whenever that happens, the soundtrack audio drops out dramatically to nothing. And you can see the performers turn around and look off camera. And then the sound comes back when the guy stopped yelling.
But where's the parody? They're dressed like Batman.
Oh, yeah. There's like a Batman, a Batgirl character. And she,
it sounds very like unnecessary.
I would have to think there's probably historical. I'm interrupting. Go for it.
She rides a bouncy ball.
What?
Yeah, like she travels. That's her vehicle.
I'm sure some people have researched this. If it's out in the world now, is there any sense of where it was shot? Like what part of the country? Or
probably everyone who researched it, we know.
Yeah, probably.
And
but
maybe listen.
If it's on disc, people is out there.
There is a commentary track or two on our Blu-ray of it, and there must be some knowledge to share.
Who did the commentaries?
I think Lisa's on one, and there's this other guy who's like a Bat Pussy historian.
Wow. my God. Bat Pussy.
What did you think?
I thought you said Bad Pussy.
Oh, come on, John.
I don't know anything about that.
You're the Bat Pussy scholar.
But Bat Pussy. Yeah, no, I probably know tons of that scholars.
It just seemed like the perfect thing to introduce ourselves to the world with.
Yeah.
Because it was an object. It's like Enchanté Amour, only totally not.
Yeah. Well, also I think Amy Taubin this weekend is showing the Jack Smith Andy Warhol Batman parody.
Batman Dracula
at MoMA. So perhaps someone should tell Amy Taubin about Bat Pussy.
I'll tell her.
On this
trip,
you
go see Batman Dracula.
I will. I'm going to. And then we're going to record another Screenslate podcast.
I know. I really want to do one with Amy.
We should. That'd be great.
Yeah, at some point. Definitely.
I went to MoMA for the first time on this trip.
Wow.
I liked it.
What did you see?
The Museum of Modern Art.
Yeah.
Titus 2? Titus 1?
Were you in the little theater or the big theater?
The 2, which I guess is the smaller one. Yeah. And it was yesterday at 1 p.m. for the Rialto Trailers show.
Oh, okay.
I was like, that is so high concept that I can't miss that.
What was it? What was your favorite?
This Iranian film called The Runner, which I'd never heard of.
Oh, that's a great trailer.
That trailer uses
so
this
good
throbbing synth track.
Yeah.
That really gets you in the mood for this movie.
And how much of it was projected on 35 millimeter? Was it all DCP or
the trailer show?
Yeah, the trailer show.
It was all digital.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. It was stuff that they'd done in the last 10 years, but I take it from the credits that they ran afterwards, a lot of them were adapted from previous trailers.
I see.
That they had cut. They slightly revised their own trailer.
Man, we have to get the Bruce Goldstein racket going if we want to survive as film programmers. The whole like, start a distribution company, get like a well-funded nonprofit programming job, and just program my own movies.
It's a great racket. Nice work if you can get it.
Yeah, he intro'd the show. He was amusing.
Yeah, no, he's definitely a brilliant dude. He knows what to buy too. Yeah.
And it turns out,
I believe he owns like Total Recall now and Rambo, because they were all part of the Studio Canal.
Yeah, I saw also that he,
like, all the Kuroko stuff became part of Studio Canal.
And part of that MoMA series was Escape from New York.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
I was like, what? What? I was very confused by that.
Studio Canal owns the rights to all these things, and Rialto is Studio Canal's US partner.
Yeah, yeah. Now we're getting back into the meat. And it is that detective work where it's like, these were owned by this company. They, you know, bankrupted themselves by frankly making shit like Beau is Afraid. Then Studio Canal absorbed their library.
Yeah,
then,
exactly.
You know,
it's exactly. Like in Chinatown where when he goes in to like look up all the people who had obituaries written and finds that all this land in the valley sold to people who are dead now. You got to go into like a hall of records and like start poking around and like looking at all these different like 80s tax shelter companies and stuff.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Well, good on Bruce Goldstein for getting Escape from New York.
Yeah, yeah.
A masterpiece.
Which I just watched the good other property. Night on 4K.
4K UHD.
Yeah.
What are they going to call after 4K? Like when they make a new
8K?
One?
8K?
There will be no planet.
No, I know, but will there...
Unless we blow up pipelines.
Will there be like a UUHD? Ultra HD?
No. I think UHD is the last optical disc format.
Okay.
I mean, like...
That's 8, it. There's
8K
no more after that.
Exists, but...
But they're like, not going to do it on a disc.
No, it'll
no
be
one's
digital.
Going to tell a difference on a 4K TV or...
Yeah.
8K, 4K.
The next release will just be all digital streaming. There's not going to be no more optical discs after UHD.
But there's not going to be a future.
That's true.
They said radio was going to kill the movies.
I told you that.
Yes. We were talking about this last night.
We were talking about this last
but
night.
What turn- oh, can oh, no, we two
talk-
nights ago.
Can you we talk about the movie that we watched, though? The half movie that we half watched? As our one
the
movie,
half movie that you half watched.
Yeah,
like
we
that.
Watched the pilot for Crime Story.
Oh yeah,
on
oh,
YouTube. Wow.
Abel Ferrara's pilot for the Michael Mann executive produced Crime Story.
Yeah,
wow. 1986.
Dennis
Farina in a 1960s period cop show or cop
it's like
show.
A late 50s, early 60s, like Hairspray era.
What year was that? This made
86.
You said
it. Yeah, it was concurrent with Miami Vice and all that.
Wow.
Yeah.
Damn.
That's just on YouTube.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, with ads if you don't pay for YouTube.
And it's a very expensive piece of television. There's these tracking shots, crane shots, violence.
There's crazy stuff.
Yeah.
Like insane car chase. I watched New Rose Hotel last night inspired by.
We were talking about that. Yeah. Yeah, and
I thought it was pretty neat.
Okay.
Man. It's got a lot of stuff going on. I think it works, you know.
I'll give it another watch. I'm huge Abel Ferrara fan. Huge.
Then you will love New Rose Hotel because it's a very Abel Ferrara movie.
But I didn't remember liking it. I'll go back and see it.
Go back and see it. It's on Tubi.
And it can't be all bad if it's just Christopher Walken just talking.
It's him, Willem Dafoe, and Asia Argento. And
Star of Demons too, Asia Argento.
Yeah.
But I did want to ask Brett, this is kind of a lame question also, but like, what do we have to look forward to from AGFA?
Oh, so many things. So there's a... there's a John Mortsugu box set that's coming out in August.
Oh, yeah.
I restored his first film, Dur Elvis.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think we weren't allowed to. I'm just guessing.
Yeah. Exactly.
Obviously, for some of them. But we restored and we're putting together all of his features or the vast majority of his features.
Yeah, he's awesome.
And he's done commentaries on all of them.
Also, I want to say him and Amy. Favorite Instagram couple. Like if you follow both of them on Instagram,
they're so in love.
Trip.
It's so cool. They have a great life together.
Well, he's also just a super nice guy.
Yeah.
You know. Very cool guy.
So that's coming up on the home video side. On the theatrical side, we're hopefully gonna be doing Messiah of Evil towards the end of the year.
Yeah.
And we're gonna be printing some new 35 millimeter prints, I think.
Wow.
At some point, because we want to get into that and spurring print tours, because the print tour is a very rare thing these days.
Hmm. For sure. And that was like so standard for a while, you know, like earlier 35 millimeter restoration kind of efforts. But that one was shot in Technoscope, right? So that's going to be like a super wide print. Messiah of Evil, it's like, I think it was shot in 2 perf Technoscope.
But you didn't necessarily you didn't say you're necessarily making new prints of that one.
No, it's just we'll
just in general.
New
oh,
prints.
I thought you meant of Messiah of Evil.
I mean, that sounds awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe one day.
Yeah,
that's cool. Great. I mean, I think people really appreciate 35 millimeter more after COVID than they did, you know, maybe in 2019.
Yes, yeah. I agree. And I would count myself in that because in LA, I just showed Albert Pune's Nemesis on 35. Mm. And it was a movie that I hadn't seen before. but I knew it was a good idea to play because some of the other Alamos had recently played it. And I fell in love with it, and I think the film and the film look kind of did it for me. I would have been really less inclined if it was a DCP or something.
Do you know anything about, is there a print, or perhaps you even have a print of Radioactive Dreams? Because I've tried to watch that at home, but it's like a shitty DVD, and I'm like, I can tell this movie is supposed to look so much better. Mm-hmm. But I've never seen that. Would really like to see that. But
I'd have to look it up. I can't remember if that's in our archive. All right, or not.
I'm going to pull up the spreadsheet.
got it in my bag.
Let's grill
man.
You. Every single film you're going to make prints on.
And Caroline. Sorry.
Oh, I'm just trying to think of any last fun things.
What about disc releases?
Well, there is the John Mortsugu. And then we are reissuing some stuff that's been out of print. And we're going to be doing a sequel to our trailer show that's going to come out.
On disc?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's going to be very found footagey, obviously. It's what we love. Making something out of nothing. We have all these trailers in our archive with thousands of them.
So, hell yeah.
Hell yeah.
Something that's coming out by one of our label partners, but we get to do screenings of, and I'm absolutely thrilled. We did the restoration for this one, too. The Rubber Gun, directed by Alan Moyle, who did Times Square and Pump Up the Volume and Empire Records. A couple years before Times Square, he's in Montreal, and he directs this movie, The Rubber Gun, and it's so cool. It's like a cross between the Warhol and Cassavetes and John Waters axes, and it's got the Canadian flavor on top of it.
The French-Canadian flavor on top of that.
And there's even a guy, there's like a cute French-Canadian guy in it. He's like one of the druggy cast members. He's kind of amazing. Pierre is his name. Ooh. And Stephen Lack from Scanners.
Yeah, follows Screen Slate on Instagram, by the way.
Oh, he is.
No big deal.
Such a huge fan of Stephen Lack. I'm so glad that's finally happened. I talked to him on the phone some years ago about maybe trying to preserve The Rubber Gun, but Canadian International Pictures is actually doing it, and they're going to do a whole special edition, and I'm fucking thrilled. This is a movie that I can see The New Yorker writing a thing about because it's so unseen, and it covers all these different kind of pockets of art and music. The score is amazing by this guy Louis Fury, who's sort of like Dr. John but a cabaret performer. It's like it's very singular. Cool. And Stephen Lack at the center of this film is on fire. He's in Scanners, he's incredibly subdued. He's like, when he's called upon
in Scanners, other people are on fire.
That's true.
That's all right.
He's
I love how Brad was laughing and the two of you were just like, whatever,
we're used to it.
I was just thinking about how great Canadian International Pictures is as a name
of
a company.
How do you pronounce that? Kip or SIP?
They say CIP.
That's just a great
name.
There's
an American International Pictures too.
I know.
So who is gonna get it together with Mexican International Pictures so that we can have like the NATO International
Pictures.
That would be a six
North American
series.
North American
like, this
International.
This is how programming happens. It's happening live right now.
Yeah.
NATO.
A continent-wide effort to preserve and perpetuate genre filmmaking.
The NATO of trash.
It's not trash. It's genre.
So I'm putting in your minds early.
The Rubber Gun.
The Rubber Gun.
All right.
Where are you going to premiere it in New York?
I have no idea.
But The New Yorker will be writing about it.
And just because it feels like
it sounds like an automatic screen slate.
You're right. I think you're right.
Yeah.
Screen slate pick of the day, definitely.
Yeah.
Look, it's fucking dope. That's what I want to impress upon everyone.
All right.
Like, it's really awesome.
We could get Cosmo Bjorkenheim to whip up 400 words.
Should airdrop all of us the screener link right now.
Well, Brett Berg of AGFA Museum of Home Video, it's been a total pleasure to have you on the show. Of course, when we first conceived of doing a podcast, Brett's name was at the top of the list, and it was always like, whenever you're in New York, we got to do this, and now we've done it. So thank you for coming on the show.
And I really enjoy the New York LA sort of get together.
Yeah.
Yeah. Should happen more often. Yeah, you should not be afraid of us.
Yeah, totally. No, man.
And y'all should not be afraid of us.
This is true.
Likewise.
And then we come together and heal as a nation.
All right, everyone. Thanks for listening to the Screen Slate podcast. If you want to stay in touch with what Brett is doing, visit AmericanGenreFilm.com and MuseumOfHomeVideo.com. We have links to those and more in the episode description. And if you want to hear tons of more gossipy LA film history,
and lots more, visit patreon.com/screenslate. Become a member to hear the full-length bonus episode with Brett, available now. I'm going to drop a short excerpt of it at the end of this one. This one was hosted, produced, recorded, and edited by me, John Derringer, and co-hosted by Caroline Gollum and John Klaxman. Next week, Anay Prakash returns to the pod to talk about the latest installment of the experimental film festival Prismatic Ground, opening May 3rd. We're also going to host an after party for that. You can find details for that on our Instagram. You're not going to want to miss it, so be sure to subscribe in iTunes, Spotify, Google, or wherever you get your pods. All right, we'll see you soon. Thanks for listening.
He had usurped ownership of the business from Dorothy Hampton in some kind of maneuver. Mm-hmm. And then in the 90s, he ran it as the silent movie theater.
Oh, so he like took advantage of this like poor old woman. Yeah. And damn.
Yeah. He gained her confidence as a confidence man does.
But he got it in the end.
Because he was murdered in the building.
By his lover.
By his lover at the concession stand. And
I heard it was upstairs and not in the concession stand.
Really?
That's what I heard.
But wasn't this some kind of love triangle?
I heard it was like a jealous lover thing and they were shot upstairs.
Well, my silent movie theater story is I was doing a show for Anthology at CineFamily, and about a week or two before I went out to LA to do the show, a letter from Kenneth Anger comes in the mail, and it's a newspaper clipping of that murder. It's not a Xerox. It's like actually a newspaper clipping of the murder, which happened, what, in the late 90s?
97.
And I'm like, why? Kenneth Anger is mailing me an actual clipping from a late 90s newspaper about a murder at the venue that I'm about to give a show some films at. And I was like, this is so bizarre.
I like that he had that clipping handy.